Welcome to the panel on biomass energy. Is it really green? And I appreciate everyone coming and being here so early and making it in here so quickly after the other panel went a little bit long. And my name is Bruce Ritchie. I have an environmental news website called FloridaEnvironments.com, and I'm a senior writer for the new Florida Tribune, which covers policy and politics in Tallahassee, the state capital of Florida. Let me go ahead and introduce the rest of our speakers. And I've got it all out of order. To your far right is Bill Carlson. He's a principal with the Carlson Small Power Consultants, a consulting firm with offices in Redding, California, and Black Butte Ranch, Oregon. And Bill, for several years, was chairman of the Biomass Power Association, a trade group representing the interests of the nation's biomass power plant operators and owners. Next to Bill is Conrad Schneider. Since 1997, he's worked as advocacy director for the Clean Air Task Force, a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to restoring clean air and healthy environments through scientific research, education, and legal advocacy. He previously was air project leader with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and he's a former civil rights attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice, and he served as a law clerk for U.S. District Judge Robert H. Hall in Georgia. And by the way, the full bios of each of these gentlemen and Meg is online. You can click on it. Meg, I'm going to jump over to Dave. We've got Margaret Sheehan. Meg is an environmental lawyer based in Massachusetts, and she recently led a campaign in Massachusetts to ensure that biomass energy as part of the state renewable energy requirement is consistent with goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. She was an assistant attorney general with the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office, and she is president of the Biomass Accountability Project and a board member of the Earth Justice Network. And lastly, we have Dave Atkins, who I really appreciate for filling in late at the last moment. Brian Kearns with the University of Montana had a family situation come up, a personal situation, and he helped me find Dave, who is a wonderful find. And he works with the state and private forestry branch of the U.S. Forest Service in Missoula. And for the past 10 years, he's been the Woody Biomass Utilization Program manager for a six-state area. And, of course, there is more biographical information on him, too, that we're skipping over. My introduction to the biomass energy issue really started in 2007. That's when Florida Governor Charlie Crist held a news conference at the governor's mansion to introduce a company that had announced it was going to build a biomass gasification power plant in the next county over from Tallahassee, a county that's smack in the middle of the forest with plenty of wood supply. The residents there weren't too happy that no one told them that they were interested in putting a biomass plant there, and soon there were community meetings and a county commission meeting at which the company felt, I think, so affronted by the outrage that they announced that they weren't going to be locating in that county. Since then, they tried to relocate in Tallahassee and on Florida State University property, and residents and a county commission there basically drove them out, or they withdrew pending legal challenges. They've tried to relocate in another place and have recently withdrawn their application and are redoing it. In another neighboring county of Tallahassee, this would be project number three. Adage LLC pulled out of there, facing some citizen opposition. They do have a plant planned towards Jacksonville, but have a permit, but they've not yet gotten a customer. So, you know, I guess biomass. You know, President Obama says biomass is an important part of the renewable energy future. And I think it's a good story either way for reporters, because if it's true, it's going to be very exciting to watch these projects get up and replace many of the fossil fuels. If it's not true, it's certainly it's a problem issue for a lot of people who think it could be very good for landowners for domestic energy supply. And the company that wanted to locate near Tallahassee is still working to locate in Port St. Joe. I was looking at their webpage last night again, and it said that
website. It says that the power that they would produce would be carbon neutral. But there was a report that came out in June. It was commissioned by the state of Massachusetts that makes it known that such claims are complicated. The Manomet Center for Conservation Science released a study that shows that wood for energy can result in initial carbon death because wood burning releases more CO2 into the atmosphere per unit of fossil fuels. And that study led to instant headlines, such as an AP that, quote, wood power worse polluter than coal. The Boston Globe had a headline, quote, wood burning power plants may hurt global warming fight. And these stories have links at the manomet.org website, where you can find a copy of their study. Manomet issued a follow-up statement saying that such headlines are, quote, an inaccurate interpretation of our findings, which paint a much more complex picture. Quote, while burning wood does emit more greenhouse gas emissions initially than fossil fuels, these emissions are removed from the atmosphere as harvested forests regrow. The timing and magnitude of the recovery is a function of forest productivity, land management choices, and technology and fuel characteristics. The American Lung Association has asked President Obama to be more careful on this issue, saying that it's concerned about the health impacts. The Florida Medical Association has asked the state to minimize the permitting of what it calls new incinerators. I know that some in the industry don't want to turn to incinerators, or they're not incinerators. And even some members of the pulp and paper industry have raised concerns about the impact on future wood supplies that they need if the industry goes as well as quite a few people hope it will, including certainly in Florida, the state agriculture commissioner is quite committed to making it happen, and is even concerned about the legal system that allows the challenges to take place. So I'm so excited we have such a great panel to discuss these, and I'm going to let Meg Sheehan begin by talking about what the Biomass Accounting Project has been doing.
Thanks, Bruce. I'll jump right into my points. I have handouts that have more detail on the facts that I'm going to present, and really everything that you need to know about whether biomass is green is on the CD, well-known focusing or has written a song about called biomass. But I'll jump right into my remarks, and the only thing green about biomass energy is the profits that the industry is making. These are huge international conglomerates and many taxpayer dollars in the form of credits, loans, and even stimulus money to build these incinerators, and they're calling them green, as Bruce pointed out. In fact, biomass energy is dirtier than coal when it comes to greenhouse gases, most notably carbon dioxide and particulates per megawatt per megawatt hour. It is dirtier than coal for several reasons. Over 77,000 doctors across the country, including leading resources. Biomass is certainly not green. The average 50 megawatt plant, again, uses approximately 850,000 gallons per day of water to cool the turbines using a water cooling process, which is what most of the plants do. 85% of that almost million gallons a day is evaporated into the atmosphere. The rest is discharged in the form of heated effluent containing toxic chemicals. And I will try to wrap up. There's a huge citizen backlash across the country, and that's what our group has been doing, is helping citizens from Hawaii to Massachusetts. Massachusetts is changing their renewable portfolio standard to align it with our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And in terms of these carbon neutrality claims, the Federal Trade Commission has recently issued new guidelines on greenwashing that will directly address this issue and raises some concerns about the advertising that the industry does. Thank you.
Next up is Bill Carlson to answer all of that in just 5 minutes.
Excuse me, is this Margaret's?
Yes.
Thank you, Bruce. As you sit out here this morning, I would ask you to do something besides just listen and record. I would ask you to actually think. Think for yourself about what's being said here. Apply common sense, apply logic, which you all have, to some of the claims that we're going to hear today. Because at the end of the day, all we're talking about is wood. Same wood that you use in toothpicks, the same wood that you use in your fireplace, when you go camping, roast your marshmallows over, or to barbecue your steaks. Okay. That's really all we're talking about here. Okay. And I ask you not to automatically suspend the laws of economics as well, okay, because you'll be asked to do that as well. A project announced is not a project built. In the Southeast, for instance, there's been 116 major projects announced. A group called the Forestry Consulting Firm applied a simple screen to these, said, can you meet two of these seven criteria? Things as simple as, do you have a site? Only 40% of the projects passed that screen. The Manomet study, which was referred to, said that there have been 214 projects announced in New England and one built. So when you hear reports that biomass energy will overwhelm the resource, be very suspect. Be suspect of all of us that talked to you this morning. California built too many plants in the 1980s because the resource expectations were not realized because of the spotted owl fiasco that many of you remember, particularly those of you from the West. So what happened? They built over 50 projects. Okay. Did they then turn to the private forest and mow it down? They had a simple, similar set of economics to what you see in New England today. No. The plants closed. The trees stood. The laws of economics held. So here you are in Montana. Okay. Montana has a great need for the development of biomass energy in Montana for a lot of very good reasons. Okay. They need to address the insect disease and fire issues that come with the overcrowding of the forest and the inability to use some of the public resources that we have. They have a state renewable portfolio standard like Meg referred to. They have a willing utility in Northwest Energy who would like to replace 200 megawatts of firm coal power that they get from eastern Montana with the same amount of biomass power by 2014. You have sawmills with old boilers. There's one boiler, two boilers in Montana that are over 100 years old that need to be replaced. Okay. Great candidates for combined heat and power. You have low residual prices. The one pulp mill in Montana, which was here in Missoula, closed about a year ago, and they've had basically no market for their materials. You have... It's very popular with the public, and you have serious state and federal support here locally, not the least of which is Dave Atkins here. But despite 5 years now of frenzied activity on the part of myself and many others in Montana to cause something to happen here in the arena of biomass, not a single project of scale is close to reality. Not one. Biomass power here and elsewhere is boxed in by material going to higher and better uses, as it should, by other cheaper renewables, by lower levels of federal support, by low fossil fuel prices, and by utilities limits that are placed on utilities on how much extra they can pay for renewable power. You have little to fear from this fuel and this technology. The Manomet study is simply fatally flawed because it looked at biomass energy on the wrong scale. An isolated stand of trees and its short-term fate is not the issue when in U.S. forests we have been increasing standing inventory in carbon for 70 years or more, including in Massachusetts. While trees are indeed cut, used, and burned, the trees around it are absorbing more carbon than is being released every day. The proper issue is not carbon release from a stand of trees. It is the sustainability of the resource. Until we begin using forests at a rate above their growth rate, we indeed approach carbon neutrality with biomass power. The bigger threat to the forest and carbon balance in this country is the underuse of the resource. On public lands, the inability to treat leads to insects, disease, and fire, as we see, and major carbon release. On private lands, a lack of markets leads to no investment in productivity and ultimately disposal of trees and conversion to other uses, a far greater threat. Biomass energy represents simply an opportunity for landowners of all kinds to utilize slash excess material and undesirable species to improve, hold on to, and expand the resource. In other words, to keep forests as forests. Are we really to believe that a system that utilizes the above-ground carbon for energy that is going to be cycled back to the atmosphere anyway is worse for greenhouse gas buildup than one that produces energy by digging or drilling for carbon from under the earth to release it? If the earth got all its energy from sustainably grown biomass, would it have a greenhouse gas problem? The answer is, of course not, because that's where the buildup greenhouse gas comes. If true on a macro scale, it's also true on a micro scale. The Vadovet study flies in the face of virtually every other major scientific study, which concludes that sustainably grown forests utilized for long-lived products and energy are perhaps our best carbon mitigation tool. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I'd like to say that I did invite Manmet to come and discuss their study, and they very much wanted to come, I believe, for facing some of the travel costs and limitations that, fortunately, our panelists were able to overcome. Conrad Schneider, can you take this broaden the issue for us a little bit?
Sure. Hi, I'm Conrad Schneider. I'm the Advocacy Director of the Clean Air Task Force. Thank you all for being here today. And I'm going to sort of pick up where Meg left off and really focus on the greenhouse gas issue, some of the ones that Bill just talked about. Let me just start by saying, how many of you are from states where there's a renewable portfolio standard? And of all those, how many of is biomass ineligible? Yeah, actually, it's all of them. Except Massachusetts, where that's been suspended right now because they're taking a closer look as a result of the amendments. So these renewable portfolio standards, and at the federal level, the idea of a renewable energy standard, were passed for a number of different reasons, indigenous resources, energy security, to help the local economy, and so forth. But one of the claims, I think it's fair to say, was that there would be clean energy. And the question today is biomass green? Does it qualify for that? And as Bruce said, you know, a common sense way to think about that is it cleaner than fossil? Because if it's not, why are we subsidizing it? Why are we creating a quota to create those that type of energy? So if it did turn out that the energy produced by these RPSs and biomass in particular turned out to be more polluted than fossil, that would be news. And one measure of cleaner I'm going to focus on is greenhouse gases. And to put that into some context, you know, nationally, we know that we need about an 80% reduction in carbon dioxide from the entire economy by about 2050 in order to do sort of our share of the lift to get where we need to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. And because, as you know, transportation sector reductions are so difficult, the power sector is probably going to have to do even more. We're probably going to have to see almost zero carbon from the power sector by 2050 or so in order to get in that ballpark. And that's a huge, huge lift. And the most important thing to take away from that is that by 2050, so the next few decades are critical, because that's when the buildup and the sort of synergy in the system is going to happen to create those temperature increases that we're worried about. Now, you all know the rule of holes, right? What is it? When you're in a hole, stop digging. So the issue is here, is biomass green? Is it cleaner than fossil? So I don't think it's been disputed here, but let me just repeat it, because a lot of people are a little stunned to think if you have two power plants producing the same amount of electricity, one from coal and one from biomass, which produces more greenhouse gases on a straight-up emissions basis? And the answer is biomass, by 50% more. Now, that's not so surprising. Coal is an incredibly energy-dense, you know, fuel. Biomass isn't. It has to overcome a lot of different things. And plus, the efficiency of the plants themselves today, typically, is less than a coal plant, certainly less than a gas plant. The only reason biomass is even in this discussion is because of this issue of regrowth, the notion that this carbon dioxide that's emitted when the wood is burned can then be absorbed and sequestered by growing forest. In other words, forests are CO2 sinks, as we know. But if you really look in terms of closer examination to this idea of carbon neutrality, it doesn't hold up to common sense. In Massachusetts, the concerns that were raised by Meg and others led the DOER to commission the Manomet studies you've heard about. And Bruce accurately characterized that as saying, you know, you build up, by burning the wood now, you build up a carbon debt. It takes decades before the regrowth and the reabsorption and sequestration so it overcomes that and turns it into a carbon credit or a carbon sort of benefit. These are the very decades we care most about, those between now and 2050. So if it's going in the wrong direction for the next few decades, it's going in the wrong direction and it's digging the hole deeper. Because as some famous economist once said, in the long run, we're all dead anyway. Okay. But the Manomet study did sort of a rather static and simplistic mode of analysis that misses some of the other problems that are sort of inherent in this. It assumes that these forests are going to be around and sort of taking in the carbon dioxide for these decades, but there's no requirement in the RPSs that they do so. Now, let's say that an organization like SEJ decided they were going to make this conference carbon neutral. I don't know, maybe they did. I don't know. We all flew here, we all drove here, whatever, and we emitted some carbon doing it. And typically, you know, universities and corporations that are looking to be carbon neutral, you know, even rock conservators will say, we're carbon neutral. And usually the way they achieve that is by what? Planting trees in Guatemala, right? That's the caricature of it. But it would be a sham. It would be a sham if we didn't think that those trees were going to be around for at least decades, if not 100 years, if not permanently. So one of the ideas behind a carbon offset is permanence. Another idea behind a carbon offset is it's additional, that it wouldn't have happened anyway. Otherwise, there's no net benefit to it. And this is one of the flaws of what Bill said. Right, he's saying that if as long as the forest grows faster than the biomass industry, then you're okay. That's not true unless you're setting aside land and locking up the carbon, because otherwise it's just business as usual. Right, you're not getting any net gain out of it. Okay. So and then the last point I want to make is that carbon neutrality is not necessarily climate neutrality, because when the wood is burned, the emissions happen instantaneously. But it takes decades, and that means the warming is happening quickly and in that time scale that we care about. And then the regrowth and sequestration and so forth is a slow process, and it takes time to overcome that. So you're putting the energy into the system and then gradually taking it out. So if we're worried about, you know, returning to 450 or 350, as Bill McKibben says, then how are we going to do that? We're digging the hole. Now, okay, thanks. So let me just say one thing about the Manomet study and whether it's sort of applicable to other areas, because you know maybe Montana is the ideal case for a situation where you've got biomass energy, because there's stands of insecticide infested dead forest standing stands. You know, the issue, and so there may be a way forward in which biomass could be green, but right now we don't distinguish one from the other. You know, southern tree plantations, Massachusetts woodlots, Maine, where I come from, where the paper industry is active and there's a lot of forest residue, and out here where there are stands of dead trees, all of those are different. But what really matters is what the biomass burners are burning. And even though Bill's organization, the Biomass Power Association, says that they don't harvest trees and they don't burn whole trees, etc., if you look on the websites of their members, you'll find that is not exactly true, and I can get into that. Bruce has given me the
yeah, we need to pass on to Dave. We'll come back to some of your points in the Q&A.
Great. Thanks.
And we want to leave time for everyone to be able to ask questions, or some of you.
Okay, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and participate in this. It's a really important discussion to have. I have a handout there, so think there's some basic points that I want to hit, and then I'll try and expand on those with the time that we have. First, yes, biomass power is green, but there are different shades of green. And the Manomet study did a very nice job of highlighting that, and I'll explain more on that. The other point I want you to think about and remember is if you don't grow it, you mine it. Okay? Third one, it's the fossil fuel. It's the fossil carbon that is the problem. 100 million year old stored carbon being released. Forest carbon is new carbon. It's part of the carbon cycle. And if you're doing sustainable forest management, that carbon is not adding to greenhouse gas driven change. Sustainable forest management needs to be looked at in context. The biomass power is just one sliver of sustainable forest management. So those are the basic points that I want you to hang on to. Now I'll expand on that. Yes, it's green, and part of what makes it green is when you're burning waste wood, wood that would be burned anyway to dispose of it, to meet laws that are on the books in many states to reduce wildfire hazard, that carbon is being released. And so if you turn around and burn that wood and produce energy, you are now offsetting fossil fuel that would have been used. So in that situation, you're actually reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. The other part of that shades of green is the efficiency. And the Manomet study did a really nice job on that. A dedicated power plant is not very efficient, and that's been pointed out. About 20 to 25% of the energy conversion. Combined heat and power, and there are different types of that, heat-led, power-led, so that ranges from 45 to maybe 75% efficient. Thermal heat only use of biomass is in that 60 to 80 plus percent efficient. And so you definitely want to look at what are the appropriate incentives so that we're being as efficient and we're getting as dark a green use of the biomass as possible. Are we asking the right question? I don't think so. We're focused in on biomass power, and we get down into the weeds and get into the nitty-gritty. I think a more appropriate question is, in 2050, what's a sustainable society look like? What's that going to take? And what's the role of sustainable forest management in that? We have, through sustainable forest management, the opportunity to have those trees absorb carbon dioxide, store that carbon dioxide in those live trees, but also do sustainable harvesting and have that wood utilized in structures and offset very energy intensive materials such as concrete, steel, and aluminum. And so by using wood, we can actually reduce the amount of energy we need. So it's actually a conservation tool, which is the most valuable way of dealing with climate change. So we need to look at the biomass power as one segment of this sustainable forest management approach. And so if we are using the wood waste that we cannot use for other solid wood products, then we continue to sequester that carbon in those solid wood products, and we're only taking advantage of the part that was waste. So then the question from a society standpoint is, what are the appropriate incentives for us to be able to accomplish that? Limitations of the Manomet study. There are a number. One of the things I really appreciate in that paper is that they were very transparent with the assumptions that they make, and they actually discuss some of the alternative assumptions. But there are key things that they need to look at. That artificial truncation of their analysis from a time standpoint a stand level carbon analysis versus a landscape level, this wood waste versus whole tree. Keep in mind, it's the fossil fuel. It's the fossil carbon. We need to focus on the right piece of this. There is no dividend ever with fossil carbon. This is million-year-old stored carbon. Sustainable forest management can keep that carbon in balance.
Thank you, thank you for keeping it so we can get into the questions. Now, a reminder on the rules on the question and answer. Blue tags get to answer, ask questions first. Please ask questions, don't give a speech. And I'm not sure how we should do this, so I guess we'll just do the old raise it, show and tell hand system. Yeah, stand up and we'll need you to ID yourself too.
Oh, yeah. My name is Bill Lasher. I'm a freelance journalist based in Portland, Oregon. And the question I have is this being set up as a, you'll grow it, you'll mind it. It's being set up a lot as this coal versus biomass issue. And I'm wondering why it's set up as this dichotomy. And then also, what accounting is being done for transmission of biomass power and transportation of the waste or any other products associated with the construction of the biomass plant? Because I imagine if you're building wood waste, you either have to do it within the forest, right, or do it out on some other site. So I want to know just about some of these other externalities and about why it's considered as coal versus.
Try to repeat the question.
Okay. Question is why is it being portrayed as coal versus wood? And the second part is, what about the transportation of the biomass and the transmission of the electricity? Does that get it?
Yeah.
Okay. Transmission of electricity is an issue regardless of the source. So I don't think that that's a really big question, other than the closer that you produce the electricity to the user, the more efficient it's going to be, because then you have less line loss. The question on the transportation of the biomass is a really good one, because you're using diesel fuel to chip or grind up that wood in the forest, and you're transporting it to the plant where it gets consumed. There are two pieces to this, and the example that Bill gave is if you locate a power plant, combined heat and power plant, at a sawmill, part of that biomass comes there essentially for free, because they are transporting it to harvest, to mill the logs up into their product. And so then they have bark and other waste materials that they can burn and use for the energy. So really it comes along for the ride. That other question is, if you're using that material from that waste material from the forest, you have to transport it. There's a study that was published earlier this year by some Forest Service and University of Montana researchers that looked at the energy return compared to the energy invested to do the transportation. So you're all familiar with the corn ethanol issue, and there's only about 1.5 times the energy out of the corn ethanol versus the energy in. For this analysis with the woody biomass, it varies with the distance you haul it, but the return on energy invested versus the energy out ranged from about 17 to 25. So you're getting many, many more times energy out of that wood than the energy to transport it.
What's the
coal
name of that study?
What's that?
Do you know what the name of that study was?
I can give you a card and provide you a link.
Sure. The other question, what about the other part of this question?
The coal versus biomass. It's not just coal versus biomass. You're also, with natural gas, it's much better from a carbon standpoint because the carbon density per BTU is much lower. But this whole idea of a dedicated power plant versus combined heat and power plant versus, you know, that energy efficiency still applies to natural gas. Natural gas is more efficient than coal or wood if it's only a dedicated plant. But if you turn around and do combined heat and power, then you're going to increase that efficiency.
What about solar, hydro, nuclear?
Let's take questions one at a time, okay? Yeah. Have you all...
Sure. Let me just address, I'm not going to address the transportation stuff. There are other studies that I just will say that with respect to transportation energy content, you know, and measured transporting, because you need to transport three times as much wood as you do coal to get the same amount of energy, then the transportation, you know, the equivalent transportation inputs for energy are higher. But, you know, I think one of the things you're hearing about here today is that the devil's in the details, right? It depends on what you're describing, the distances and so forth. And obviously, if you can co-locate more plants or can power this waste around that. I want to address the issue, though, of why we're talking about this relative to fossil, why we're talking about relative to coal. First of all, the Clean Air Task Force is no lover of coal. You'll find on the back table our report, Toll from Coal, which actually uses EPA's methodology to put a body count on the number of people that die every year as a result of coal power, right? So, and our vision is that by 2050, 2060, we're at, you know, between 80% reduction and 100% reduction in the greenhouse gases from the energy sector. So nobody's saying that coal can't be dealt with, right? Or doesn't have to be dealt with. It does have to be dealt with. You know, an interesting idea, by the way, in terms of this is the idea of sequestering the carbon dioxide either from coal or from biomass. And biomass is a very interesting idea is if you could actually sequester all the carbon dioxide physically by injecting it in the ground from biomass, carbon capture sequestration, it's called, you could actually take greenhouse gases out of the air and put them back in the ground. And we may be so bad off in terms of how dire the situation is from the climate perspective, we may even start thinking about technologies like that. Okay, so that's a compliment, right? But the reason that the comparison is there is because we're subsidizing biomass. We're creating a quota for biomass with these renewable portfolio standards. And Congress is considering doing a renewable energy standard. And why should we be putting our thumb on the scale to help biomass if it isn't clean, if it isn't better than coal or natural gas from a climate or other environmental perspective? That's why the comparison is relevant.
Bill, are we putting our thumb on the scale?
Well, actually, I wanted to start by answering specifically a couple of questions, just adding two, is that I have looked at over the last half dozen years or so probably 75 biomass opportunities that, when appropriately sized, I have not found a single one to date that requires any improvements to the transmission system. It's unlike wind and solar, which has to follow the resource to wherever it happens to be. Here, you locate them, like Dave said, you locate them in existing businesses, et cetera. But the other watchword in the industry is that all biomass is local, for the very reasons that Conrad talked about, higher moisture contact, lower energy density, so that the plant is always sited near the resource. And then you basically try to optimize all that, and the plants normally come out relatively small. Meg used the number of 50 megawatts as an average size. In actuality, if you look at all the plants in the United States, the average size is about 18 megawatts, about a third of what she was talking about. So these are basically small, local enterprises when done correctly.
Good question. Stand up and Dave, do you have a tag?
Yeah, I do. Hey, John, I'm sorry for the podcast. From a regulatory perspective, do the states distinguish source material, differentiate between slash material, mill waste, versus actually going out and growing and harvesting?
I'll go first and then Bill will respond. You know, interestingly, you know, Massachusetts right now is trying to figure this out as a result of the Manning study. They're trying to figure out what the guidelines should be, what the regulations should be to govern this, and the feedstock is a very important part of that. North Carolina, the Public Utilities Commission there just this past week, said that burning whole trees is okay. So on the one hand, you've heard waste, right? There's a lot of definitions of waste. You've got to figure out what waste is. And some waste may be environmentally beneficial if you burn it.
if it is truly forest residues and so forth that might be burned anyway, why not get energy out of it? So that makes sense. Or stands of dead trees, as Dave said, maybe that would make sense. But there are other, there's other waste that sometimes qualifies that isn't necessarily that way. So one of the things we would say is have a community take a closer look at that. Now, with respect, though, to burning whole trees, there are, if that's the way it's defined, and North Carolina just defined it that way, said that was eligible, then you really run headlong into this Manomet issue. Because the Biomass Power Association has said some very encouraging things about how that's not what they're after. They're not after burning whole trees. They're not after taking trees that are growing, harvesting them, and chipping them. Now, if you run a biomass boiler, that's the best stuff to burn. But they're saying that they don't do that. But those statements are belied by the statements of their members. And I'll give you a website to look at, which is really a very interesting website.
So I'd actually put the whole. You have a handout.
Oh, you have a handout that looks just like this, and Meg's done it. It's on the Environmental Working Group website, which is the link is at the top of the page. And I guess this actually goes through some of the claims and the disparities between the claims. So this is exactly the heart of the issue. There's only two ways to solve this problem in terms of making if biomass can be green, making it green. One is that we lock up the trees, right, so they can actually do the job that Bill's talking about, and Dave's talking about, of sequestering carbon, and they're not cut over constantly. This is the issue of the trees in Guatemala, right? Are they going to be cut or not, right? And the other issue is what you said, is to regulate what the feedstocks are in a way that discriminates between saying you're going to take healthy stands of whole trees and cut them and burn them versus, you know, what's been portrayed here is that there's an alternative that's environmentally okay, that would be waste.
Meg wants to answer, and we need to repeat the question for the listeners at home. I think the question was, what about no waste and wood waste and other forms of wood?
It seems like we've gotten off onto this definition of biomass, and as I mentioned, different states have different definitions. In some states, it includes burning tires, garbage, agricultural waste, often contaminated with pesticides that results in the creation of dioxin when burned. I'd also like to touch on the transportation issue, and again, another thing that has been very compelling to communities that are faced with these incinerators is the transportation of the fuel. It takes approximately, say, for 150 megawatt plant, actually, I don't know if you got that point too, but around 200 truck trips a day. Often these are plants that are located in rural towns. People have trucks going through. We've been trying to reduce diesel emissions because of the impacts on public health, asthma rates, and whatnot. That's a factor to be considered. The creation of ash, when the trees are burned, there are usually about 2 truckloads of ash per day that have to be shipped off-site. That's another source of diesel emissions. And so it really comes down to why are we even considering this when it's on the same platform as wind and solar and conservation and efficiency. We shouldn't even be talking about burning stuff to create clean energy. People get it that green energy doesn't come from a smokestack. And I'd just like to address the point that has been raised that somehow the CO2 from burning a tree is different from the CO2 of burning a fossil lump of coal or natural gas. CO2 is CO2. The atmosphere does not care where it came from. This discussion about biogenic carbon and being part of the carbon cycle above ground is a red herring. It defies common sense, especially when you consider, and the Center for Biological Diversity has made this point very clear, that we've been burning coal in this country for 200 years. Our trees are loaded with the fossil, with the carbon dioxide that was emitted when we burn that coal over the last 200 years. So some of the carbon in our trees today is actually fossil fuel carbon. So when you burn it in an incinerator to make green energy, you are releasing CO2 that was once locked up underground in coal.
Can I respond to that?
You want to move on or you want to respond?
I want to respond.
Okay.
Yes, we've been burning fossil fuels for a long time, and some of that carbon. And the point that from an atmospheric physics functioning, the CO2 doesn't make any difference. The point of the carbon being released from forests is that if you're managing your forest sustainably, there's a cycle, there's a loop, and there's no net increase. That's my point of it's the fossil carbon. That's what we have to back away from. The other part is that this isn't a battle between biomass and wind or solar or conservation or geothermal or hydro or wave, any of those things. This is about how do we have a sustainable society, and wood is got to be part of that sustainable society. And so we're going to have buildings. We've got, what, 6.7 billion people on this planet, and we're headed towards 9 in the next 20 to 30 years. How are we going to house and have buildings and structures? Wood is a sustainable way to do that, and the leftover wood is a worthwhile use of energy. To me, this comes down to what are the appropriate incentives and disincentives so that we're using the wood to its best advantage for that sustainable society. Okay, that's my point.
Okay, we've got about 15 minutes left, so we're going to race through questions as quickly as we can. Let me see the hands of people who want to ask a question. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's not going to quite work. Okay, let me see. Barbara, I want you to go ahead and
answer. Actually, I'm going to knock out pass.
Okay. Put the hands back up again. Do you have a blue tag?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Jennifer, and what's your name?
Sarah.
Sarah, you're next, and what's your name?
Jared.
You got a yellow tag. I'm going to come back to you. Best, you have a? Okay, you'll be fourth. You'll be fifth. Okay. Jennifer, go.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jennifer Weeks. I'm a freelance writer from Boston. Hopefully mine is a fairly quick question. Are any biomass plants running now gasifying the wood, or are they all just straight combustion? And if you could go to a lot of gasification, would that improve the efficiency and maybe be a sort of jump ahead and improve some of these issues about how much energy you're getting from wood fuel?
Try to repeat the question.
The question was whether or not any of the plants that are running today are doing gasification or proposed to do gasification of wood, and would that improve the efficiency of the process? The answer is that yes, there's numerous proposals and a couple of existing facilities that gasify wood, but they typically don't today improve the efficiency of the process, simply because they simply then burn the gas produced and use the same downstream equipment that it would be if you had combusted it in standard water. The truth of the matter is gasification is an overused term anyway, because every combustion unit that combusts biomass at some point in that unit is indeed a gasifier, because it basically produces a gas and then burns the gas, sometimes in the same vessel, sometimes in another vessel, until the gas is able to go to a gas turbine directly, which it can't do today because some of the liquids and stuff that go with it. That will be the dramatic efficiency improvement we're looking for, but people have been searching for that for decades and haven't been able to perfect it.
That's not a game changer.
No, but not in the near term. Ultimately, it may well be.
Formerly with Nebraska Public Radio, where I sometimes cover wildfire and some of these issues. You know, Bill touched on the overgrowth issue, and many forests obviously have overgrowth. We've talked about, you know, dead trees and such, but foresters I've talked to have said, you know, we have a lot of these overgrown forests thanks to fire suppression that are just waiting to be attacked by beetles, and wildfire and likely are going to end up burning anyway. I guess I'd ask Margaret or possibly Connors to comment on that. Is there a place for forest thinning for biomass to address those areas?
Can I defer to Dr. Sammons on that?
I'm not going to allow Meg to defer to Frank Sammons here to answer. Could you come up here, please, Frank?
I do have handouts that address this, and the scientists that I have talked to indicate that this is another red herring, that it is not good for forest health to go through and extract to avoid wildfire.
Briefly introduce yourself.
are a number of studies, which I'll give you a card, I'll be happy to send you, which show that, in fact, the thinning process may not actually work effectively as a fire suppressant. It may not be better for the overall forest health. I know it's been done that way as a standard operating procedure, so that right now, as people are looking at better ways to measure carbon flux and looking at what the actual carbon benefits are of these procedures, there's a lot of new questions and new data that's come out in the last 2 years. I don't know if we have the time to go into all that right now, but I'll get you the papers.
Yeah, let me respond to that if I could. Basically, Bill should talk to some of the fire suppression specialists that are out there within the different agencies, and I think they would beg to differ with his characterization that it doesn't actually slow down the spread of fire. There's many instances where crown fires are reduced to ground fires, which is a dramatic difference in the fire suppression business because of approaching an area that's been thinned. Basically, many of these lands in the West, the lands that you're referring to, are well beyond their historic carrying capability for carrying as much biomass as they are. The nutrients are overutilized, the water is overutilized, the resource then is consequently weak. It needs to be restored back to within that range of natural variability. Biomass is one tool to do that because the vegetation you're removing is not, quote, commercial. It's sub-commercial, if you want to call it that. And you can get energy to displace fossil fuel, like Dave's talking about, by utilizing that material. You can make the removal more economic, less burden on the agency that's charged with that removal by utilizing it for, you know, some public purpose like this. Okay. I'll present you just with a very simple model that I want you to just think about. Okay? And that model is that if we really care about utilizing biomass of all kinds to reduce greenhouse gas potential in the U.S., okay, the way we should approach it is we grow as many trees on as many acres as we can as rapidly as we can grow them. Okay. When they reach the point where they're sequestering carbon less vigorously than they were, okay, and every tree reaches that point in its life, then you take that tree and you recover all the products that you can that sequester that carbon for the longest period of time. And hopefully you target those that Dave's talking about that were more energy intensive, like aluminum and concrete, and you replace those with biomass. You basically take all the pieces of that tree that would not make a commercial product. You sweep them up and you make energy out of them. You do it as efficiently as possible, and consequently you displace the maximum amount of fossil fuel in doing so, and then you repeat. That's the model I'd ask you to think about.
As I just have to respond as a forest ecologist and a forester who has fought wildfires, who has managed forests, has done prescribed burning, thinning the forest changes fire behavior. It will change the opportunity for that fire to be able to get into the crown and run. I suspect one of the points that he may be alluding to is that another effect when you open up the forest some is that you increase the opportunity for the wind speed at the ground level to move faster, and so then that fire can move faster on the ground. But I tell you what, as somebody who's fought fire and works with lots of people that still fight fire, we always prefer to fight that fire when it's on the ground and not running through the crowns of the forest.
The questioner actually asked for a response from me, so I've got 15 seconds. Does this sound complicated to you? It sounds complicated, right? Maybe there's some merit to some of these ideas that have been thrown around in terms of what the regime should be that distinguishes between good and bad biomass. But the renewable portfolio standards and so forth that's driving this right now, it's basically, I mean, they have different definitions, but it's basically anything goes. So what we're saying is take a time out, look at this issue, consider Bill's proposal for his model, and see whether it holds water when studies like Manomet and so forth are able to be applied in science, and the people who are not necessarily have a vested interest in it take a look at it and say, does this make sense or not? And then regulators are able to consider that. It shouldn't be anything goes.
if there's a way to manage the biomass industry sustainably that actually is green. And we've heard just little bits of that, and I suppose if they locked us in a room for an hour today, we could probably come up with some of those. But right now, it's basically anything goes.
Okay, 2 minute drill now.
Anyone looked at the other side of this in terms of what reducing all this organic material from the forest might mean to the ecosystems? If you do have to go after dead trees and you can't use logging waste all the time, and you have to start looking at other places, there's going to be a lot of pressure to go around here where all these dead trees are and cut them down and put them into the stove. And I just wonder if that is a lithium factor or not, and if there's a possibility of running out of the waste there.
Question was, is anyone looking at the impact of removing the organic material from the forest?
Yes, there's a lot of information on the Save America's Forest website about this and about various forestry experts and ecologists talking about the impact, negative impact. So I can talk to you more about that afterwards. Also note on my fact sheet here, it talks about according to our ISI, the leading source of forecasts and analysis for the global forest products industry, the perceived overabundance of waste wood in the nation's forests is simply not there. And so it's our view that the logical conclusion is there is going to be a lot more logging for biomass incineration. And when you think about a ton of wood a minute, is what a biomass incinerator burns, year after year, 365, 24/7 for the next 30 years, these plants have that long of a life, you can imagine you're pretty much going to clear out any waste wood around the 50-mile radius of the plant, which is they like to keep it local. So that's a huge issue, and I'll be happy to talk to you about it.
That is an issue that needs to be raised and addressed everywhere, always, and it is. We, in the forestry community, and forest management, our goal and desire is to maintain the sustainability of that forest. So we have already developed guidelines for the amount of snags, because snags are important from bird and bat habitat. Down woody debris is important from a wildlife habitat. And so it comes back to we're managing these forests for a whole variety of different values. And so, again, we don't want to focus in on. So this idea that we're going to go out and vacuum up all the biomass in the forest and burn that is a red herring. We have laws in place. We have guidelines in place that preclude that on federal forests, state forests, and we work with small landowners to develop stewardship plans so that they are managing their forests sustainably. So I think we need to ask that question. It's an important question, and we need to have that question answered. And I think it goes to Conrad's point that, you know, if we continue the discussion, we can find that there's lots of common ground here. And it's not an either-or situation. So then what it really comes down to is what are the appropriate levels and levers and measures in our state and federal policy to assure that we're doing this sustainably?
I'll make it quick. When I use the term sustainability, I also always incorporate such things as long-term soil productivity, protection of water quality, protection of wildlife habitat. When I use that term, that biomass grown sustainably, all that is incorporated into that. And I think everyone else in the business uses it in the same way, that when you use a term, it's simply implied that all of those things have to be protected in the long term, and you're not going to take everything off. To Meg's point about cutting every tree down within 50 miles, it's that darn law of economics again. You're just not going to see it happen because it makes no sense economically. You can make a great story out of it, but economically it's never going to happen.
Hi, I'm Alice Pacheco, Knight Center, Michigan State. So, Bill, you said that making this crop sustainable is planting as many trees on as many acres as fast as possible. One of the concerns with ethanol is that you're taking up agricultural land that we're using to grow our food on. Is that a concern? Where are we going to put
basically, typically what you talk about is marginal agricultural land that basically may not be able to support a crop or may not have the ground density you're looking for a food crop. And these are the lands we're talking about. Basically, the bottom line is, though, I was chaired a panel recently that spent a year looking at all these issues with a broad variety of stakeholders, including several from the environmental community. And the bottom line is, if you provide appropriate markets for landowners, they will invest in the productivity of those lands. And the productivity potential increases are dramatic, doubling, tripling, quadrupling the amount of wood that can be grown on an acre each year. Okay. So it doesn't necessarily take a lot more acres, okay, but it takes attention to the ones that are out there. It takes investment in the lands that are out there, and that takes markets. Without markets, the trees won't stand there forever because the owner can't afford to hold on to them. He will eventually have to sell to a developer or turn it into a shopping center.
Bruce, can I just very briefly? It's a great question. The Clean Air Task Force was one of the groups that brought to light the problem of corn ethanol and other ethanol in terms of its indirect land use impacts and pressure that it puts on development. It's a concern. So, and what I just heard Bill say again was, you know, that these forests are managed sustainably and so forth. So if you were talking about a climate regime like the U.S. Congress is trying to pass, where there were offsets for forestry, right? There were actually offsets that were part of the program. There were at least minimal requirements that they had to have to demonstrate that they were going to be around long enough to offset the carbon that they were where it was claimed. Otherwise, the program is a sham. So do we say we're going to trust forest management to deal with this? Or are we going to have a regime that actually guarantees it? We're being asked to take on a carbon debt without a guarantee of a carbon dividend. And there shouldn't just be this general notion that people are managing the forest in thus and such a way, but rather some guarantee that if we're going to allow people, give people incentives to put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that there's a guarantee that on the other side, on the carbon dividend side, for the sequestration, that it's actually going to happen. And that concerns like that were raised in the questioner do not happen.
Sorry. I'll just quickly stay on that. You know, I just want to highlight that, for example, the 100-megawatt wood-burning incinerator in Florida, where are they going to get their fuel supply? Now they're saying they're going to use urban yard waste and urban trimmings. That has nothing to do with trees. They're not even pretending that they're going to go out and plant trees to re-sequester all the carbon that they release from burning all these urban trimmings from the city of Gainesville.
That is a different project than what I was referring to.
Let me give an example. St. Paul, Minnesota has a district energy system that runs 80% on biomass, and primarily that is from urban wood waste, tree trimmings, shrubs. They get ice storms, damaged trees get old, they got sick, they get died. So they produce 25 megawatts of electricity. They heat over 31 million square feet of housing and office space. And in the summertime, are cooling over 21 million square feet with primarily biomass and primarily woody biomass. So urban forests are forests, just like our wildland forests are forests, and they can be grown and managed sustainably. I mean, that's the wonderful thing, is trees are solar collectors. I mean, think about the phenomenal thing that chlorophyll does. It collects sunlight and CO2 and water and creates wood and stores energy and stores carbon. And we can build things out of it. And those forests act as water filtration systems and wildlife habitat and places to go play. We can do this sustainably.
Good morning. Jerry, you mentioned the farmers in Ohio better repeat that question.
It's coming from the standpoint of agricultural versus woody biomass, and using corn stover or other agricultural residues, and the idea of growing woody, perennial woody crops in some of those places as an energy feedstock. And it really comes back to that earlier question. I participated in a workshop, and it was focused on ag, and they were talking about corn stover, and they're talking about growing corn to have ethanol. So it's an energy crop. It's not a food crop. So there's no competition with food in that situation. And then they're talking about, you know, the ability to utilize the corn stover, the stalks, for energy to make cellulosic ethanol. And so I asked the question, and I said, so why not consider a perennial woody crop where you don't have to plant it every year, you don't have to fertilize it to the same degree, you don't have to put the pesticides on it. You can actually grow some woody crops like alder that will fix nitrogen and actually improve the quality of the soil and use that for your energy crop. So I think there's a huge area here within that mixture of this agroforestry arena. And to me, the ironic thing is you look at Iowa and Illinois and a lot of those places that are now all ag, many of those areas used to be forested. And so they can be very productive from a forest standpoint, and we can go back to that. And so grow woody crops for energy rather than these more expensive, from an energy standpoint, annual farm crops.
These are our final answers. Here's the...
I'll just respond to that and say, in your handout you have a fact sheet from Buckeye Forest Council in Ohio, where I believe there are, at this point, something like 16 wood-burning biomass plants being planned. I can email you the Google Map link. But again, it's the Wild West. There are no requirements that these plants, including the burger plant in Ohio that's converting from coal to burning whole trees, there is no requirement that they use a switchgrass or a corn stover or something that might have a better greenhouse gas life cycle than cutting down a tree. So these are all great ideas, but there's no regulation in place. The Renewable Portfolio Standard, as Conrad mentioned, says anything goes. And that's exactly what's happening. And we've heard stories about the great combined heat and power out in Minnesota. That's a totally, that might be great, but there is no requirement in the law that if you want to get these billions in taxpayer ratepayer subsidies for your biomass incinerator, you don't have to use corn stover. You don't have to be combined heat and power. You don't have to meet any minimum efficiency of anything. You don't have to prove that your forestry is sustainable. You basically, just by saying I'm green and I'm biomass, you are entitled to these huge subsidies, and this is happening now. That's why people are, I can give you websites and links to community groups across the country that are coming out. I've been doing environmental law for 30 years, grassroots organizing. I have never seen people filling up their town halls, marching down to the state house, outraged about the public health effects from this industry, the impacts on their children, their forests, their rivers, their air, etc. So I think we need to realize that there are no rules, and it's the Wild West. And we can talk about all these great things about sustainability, which really has no definition anyway. And I'll leave it at that.
just some final thoughts. Harken back to two points. One is, there's been a series of these relatively large dispersed biomass plants in California now for coming up on 25 years. Okay. Where are all those terrible consequences that Meg talks about? Okay. There's hundreds of megawatts of these plants that have been there. If you ask the man on the street, he would tell you that they've been overwhelmingly positive for the resource, overwhelmingly positive for the economy, okay, that there's not people dropping dead in the streets. They've not dewatered all the rivers in California. Okay, it's been an overwhelmingly positive experience. And I leave you with one thought, which basically one of Conrad's points reminded me of it, and that is, if you could, at the end of the day, sequester the carbon coming out of the stack of the biomass plant, imagine the system you could have. Okay, you have these small biomass plants dispersed locally. You have one in every community, essentially. It's taking all of the woody waste material from that community. It's supplementing it with the excess growth in the forest. Basically, as the plants absorb carbon of all kinds, you take them to your plant, you burn them to get the energy to keep the fossil fuel that Dave talked about in the ground, and then you capture the carbon that's coming out of it and you put it in the ground. Now you have an entire system of plants that are actually cleaning the air. And we can't do that today. Okay, we certainly can't do it cost effectively today. We'll be lucky to build the plant at all without the carbon sequestration piece to it. But when we reach that point, can you imagine what a system we would have where each one of these communities has one of these that is actually cleaning the carbon out of the air? But the point is, we can get a portion of the way there now. We can build the plants to displace fossil fuel, and we can at least make that step today.
Conrad, are you finished?
Yeah, just a very quick note at the end. I want to just leave you with the idea that what we need to do is we need to go back to the drawing board and think about this more carefully, draw some regulations that guarantee some of the values that you've heard up here put out. And in the meantime, I guess the question I would have is for the biomass industry, because you mentioned again woody waste. Would the Biomass Power Association and your members be willing to agree in the interim while we figure this out to a definition that's close to the definition that you have right now, but that we will not harvest healthy standing trees for the purpose of producing energy? That's a question that I think everybody who is promoting biomass energy needs to answer, because I think there would be a different attitude with respect to these projects if we had a guarantee that that was true.
What a great way to wrap up the panel. Thank you all very much for coming here today. Thank you for the time.